actually, more correctly,
All TV Talk.
Because this episode of All Movie Talk is going to be quite unusual in that everything we're going to be talking about this episode is going to be about television and its strange and complicated relationship to movies throughout history. I'm Sam Stoddard.
And I'm Stephen Keller.
And so, why are we talking about TV on a movie podcast? How did you ever convince me to agree to that?
I think the genesis of this is we were talking about, I don't know, doing some best in decade or best in the year kind of a thing. And I think I made the argument that, well, one, I'm going to have to put The Wire on there, which I think I've done before on this show, which is a television show. I'm going to have to, no way I can talk about the best movies of the 2000s without mentioning The Wire, the greatest television series of all time. But more than that, it really kind of occurs to me that in the last decade, really, TV has become some of the most compelling filmed narrative out there. It's become more movie-like, and also, in a way, has embraced the serial nature of television to tell longer, more complex, and very interesting stories. To the point where I think if you're really interested in filmed narrative, you have to kind of pay attention to TV now, and that was certainly not the case for most of television's history.
Yeah, so I would have to begrudgingly agree with you. I've been down on TV for most of my life, probably, even though there are individual shows that I liked, but in relationship to movies, there's just no comparison. And then recently, I really have to agree. So I figured we should probably go back to the beginning and talk about how television came about, because there's interesting stuff relating to the movie industry there, too. Television has been around basically about as long as movies have. You wouldn't think so. Now, that you didn't get regularly scheduled broadcasts, but the invention of television is about as early as the invention of movies. But when would you think, I miss these trivia questions that we used to do, so I'll throw in one. When do you think the first regularly scheduled broadcast television began?
I actually think I may know this, because I think I may have looked this up recently. Was it the 20s?
Yeah. So as early as the 20s, July 2nd, 1928. Now, that wasn't network television. The regular networks that we know, ABC, NBC, and CBS, didn't come around and start broadcasting till the late 40s. There's actually another one, too. There were four originally. One was called the Dumont Television Network, and that was only around until about 1956 or so. But it was important. It was the first of the four, for one thing. And it was also responsible for broadcasting the first sitcom, the first soap opera. And it actually was the original home for The Honeymooners, too, which is one of the classics of early television. So, meanwhile, television is about to take over the nation by storm. So what's Hollywood doing about it? Well, to begin with, they're sort of bewildered, and they think it's a fad. They're not doing anything about it. They're thinking it's going to go away. But then it doesn't. It just gets bigger, and it starts becoming a really big deal by the early 50s. And so Hollywood had to address that competition, because this was definitely competing with their movies. So, you know, one of the things that happened, widescreen. You know, if you have a small screen, boxy kind of screen at home, well, if you go to the theater, you can get this widescreen and look at big panoramas. Bigger screens, too. A lot of experiments with Cinerama and that type of giant, you know, the precursors to IMAX today, they started experimenting with in the 50s. Color, although it had been around for a long time, you start seeing a lot more color movies. And big epics, the Ten Commandments and Ben-Hur, and these kinds of things that just don't work at home on television as well. And 3D, the original 3D craze in the 50s too. All of these things were related to television. They wouldn't have come out, or wouldn't have come out as soon or in the same way if television had never existed. The interesting thing, though, is that even without all these changes that the movie industry made for itself, television wasn't really anything like movies in those days. Most television in the beginning was like live theater. You'd have a still camera or two in front of a curtain and a proscenium arch, and people would come out and perform for live audiences, and it would be broadcast live as well. That's not a movie. It's very different from a movie. You certainly couldn't do the crazy things that the Expressionists did with weird camera angles and stuff like that. You didn't see that on television. It just wasn't there.
Yeah, what's funny about that is that's actually sort of what the very early movies were like. Just basically, here's a set, and we're going to film it with a single static camera.
Oh, good point.
It's interesting sort of parallel evolution there, different points in history.
Right. So movies are, at that time, were produced very differently. You'd have realistic sets, you'd have actors reenacting scenes a few times, and the cameras on different angles, and then the film would be processed and edited together. No, early TV went out live, and it was not really edited particularly. You might have a couple cameras, but that's it. So how come we can watch early television shows now? You know, if it was all live and sent out over the airwaves directly from the camera, how do you do it? Well, you may have heard of something called a kinescope. And I'm amused about what kinescopes are. But, you know, sometimes you hear about somebody found an old kinescope of this TV show, and so now it's been released on DVD after a little bit of restoration, after which it still looks bad. All a kinescope is a filmed recording of a television monitor. So it's sent out over the air, it goes to a TV screen, and somebody with a film camera tapes the screen. A little more complicated because they would synchronize the refresh rates to eliminate flicker and stuff like that. Lots of times it was 16 millimeter rather than 35, but, you know, kind of a cheesy situation there, and didn't really get good picture quality. So that's what a kinescope is. Why did they have them? Mostly because they couldn't broadcast things all over the country at once in the beginning. If you had a show recorded on the East Coast, it would go out to the East Coast live, but then the kinescopes would be shipped over by mail to the West Coast a couple weeks later, then people on the West Coast could watch it, or vice versa. If the show was recorded in the West Coast, a couple weeks later, the East Coast would get it.
They didn't just send it over the internet?
No.
Not enough bandwidth?
Well, you know, I tell you, it's surprising. The internet wasn't around at that time.
Huh.
Almost. So old radio shows did this as well, but eventually they figured out how to broadcast on the same night, so the East Coast would get the live version and the West Coast would get a kinescope 3 hours later. It is very, you read about this stuff and it's like they just hacked something together with some string and bits of wire and then it all worked. You didn't really get a national live broadcast until President Truman's speech at the Japanese Peace Treaty Conference in 1951, and then some commercial shows started doing this, and they proclaimed live coast-to-coast, because that was a big deal, the coast-to-coast thing. They did sometimes record TV shows on film. Mostly they would be low-budget shows, and the attitude was, yeah, hey, we can't afford to get a live audience. This is just a Skid Row kind of production, so we'll just shoot it on film. You know, it was the big, high-budget productions that would not be shot on film. Well, that would reverse itself. You know, well, eventually videotape would be invented. That came around in 1956, and that was a better quality recording. But the kinescopes were not good quality recordings, and that was a problem. Network executives and producers wanted to figure out how they could get a better quality image, and so they figured, well, hey, there's film. You know, duh. So they started using film for television, and it used to be less of a stigma to use that, more of a selling point. I Love Lucy, which is, you know, still, I think it's the greatest sitcom ever. It certainly continues to be popular. It's in reruns constantly. But that show is also important because it was the first show to use film and a live studio audience. That required some real technical innovation because it's hard to light for film. It's especially hard to light for film when you have multiple cameras. If you're in a movie set, you've got some time, you do one camera maybe, and then you do a separate lighting of the set to do the reverses. You know, that can be done a lot of times. But if you record something in front of a live audience and you have multiple cameras, so that you have, you know, the typical setup is three cameras. You have one in the middle doing mostly long shots, and you have the two on the ends that are able to zoom in from different faces and different angles. If two people having a conversation, you switch between the two cameras on the ends, and then the middle one gives you a wider shot, and those are edited that way.
One thing about that whole setup, too, in the live studio audience is, if you've never seen a TV set, it's really quite a bit different than the way a movie set would look. Whereas a movie set's sort of three-dimensional, a TV set is very, very much, most of the time, like a stage play would be, where you literally just have an end of the stage, and you sort of have that, you know, that missing fourth wall that doesn't necessarily exist on movie sets, because they're going to move the cameras around, and you can move actors. And that's why when you watch, especially television sitcoms, and even many of the sitcoms today, they have this really kind of static look to it. It's because the set, you know, is missing a wall, and they're very limited in terms of where they can move people.
Yeah, right. And so I was actually just watching something last night that was really interesting to me. Speaking of I Love Lucy, there was a movie, I Love Lucy, and really it was just three episodes of the show edited together and with some extra connecting footage shot for it. But in the beginning, the opening scene is an audience filing into the studio to watch the recording of an episode of I Love Lucy, and you see Desi Arnaz come out and introduce the cast and talk to the audience, and you can see the cameras, you can see the three cameras set up in front of the stage, and he's saying, oh, well, you know, we're going to be recording this, and the cameras are going to move around, but, you know, no matter where you're sitting, your eye line will not be broken by the cameras. Let me show you. And he goes and sit down and says, let's pretend we're shooting a scene here, and the cameras are going to zoom in for a close-up. And so then you see a camera zoom in right in front, and he's completely obscured from the audience, and everybody kind of laughs. It's a neat little scene, but it also shows you exactly what we're talking about, how this live thing happened when you have cameras as well. It's quite interesting. We should also mention the cinematographer for I Love Lucy, which was Carl Freund, and he figured out a lot of these technical complications here, but the reason he's interesting is he was originally a cinematographer in Germany for the movies and worked on a lot of these crazy expressionistic films where you have dramatic lighting and weird camera angles and things like that. Those movies really influenced the look of film noir in this country, so that gives you a sense of where he's coming from. And then he works on a sitcom, and he develops a system that is used for like 50 years after that. I mean, almost the present day, sitcoms have had the same kind of look to them, the same three-camera live audience setup, or at least if they had any kind of budget, then they were live. So at this point, TV shows started to be shot on film and edited in a similar way to the way movies were. TV, however, still looked fundamentally different from movies. One of the reasons is that TV tended to have standing sets. I mean, standing set basically meaning you don't tear the set down. You have a set that's there for the duration, because you'd be filming in the same sets every episode, week after week. And the higher budgeted comedies, as I said, would still have live audiences, so that would change the way it would look as opposed to movies. But, you know, even the dramas look different from movies, too. You have Dragnet and Columbo and stuff like that. They all have this TV look. Sometimes you catch a TV movie in the middle, you don't know what it is, but, you know, this has this made-for-TV look to it. And you just kind of sense that it's different from Hollywood movies. Why is that? Do you know why the dramas look different?
I think it's mainly a time and money kind of thing. Like, we talked about, obviously, the limitations of three-camera sitcoms, but on TV dramas, you tend to see a lot of very, you know, not a lot of cuts, shots that run on for a while, or just from a couple setups, because every time you have to reset up the camera and relight everything, it takes time and money. And obviously, if you're filming a drama, and let's say you're doing 25 episodes a year of an hour-long drama, you know, that's the equivalent of, what, 12 and a half feature films, basically, or 13 feature films in a given year. And, you know, previous generations, they made far more than 25 episodes a year. That's sort of around the normal for dramas now. But you just don't have as much time, you know, as much money. So you have to, and I've always noticed the same thing if you watch, like, a lot of student films or independent films, you'll see far fewer individual camera setups than you do in feature-length films where, you know, you're filming a minute or two a day versus shooting an entire hour of footage, or I guess 42 minutes for network television, over the course of, say, 6 or 7 days.
Yes. Another thing that's worth noting is that until very recently, like, I don't know, maybe 10 or 15 years, it was a gradual change, but until recently, television was considered a lower form of entertainment in Hollywood. Of course, they would think that, you know, they were the competition. But TV was something that people just casually flip on, and the movies are something you go out and pay to see, and a lot more money was spent. So TV was not considered a higher form of entertainment. So there was a stigma in Hollywood against TV, even well after it became clear that television wasn't going to ruin the movie industry and that both things could coexist and still make money. Part of it, as I said, people paid to see the big movie stars. Cary Grant, Jimmy Stewart, all those people. You pay to see them. The stars of television, you know, you flip a switch. That's it. And so for actors, and certainly for actors' agents and producers and those types of people. It was a big deal which medium an actor worked in. Movie stars were strongly discouraged from appearing on television because you'd be cheapening your marketability. If people can see you for free, maybe they're not going to shell out for your next movie. That was the fear. Probably unfounded, as we can probably figure out today, but you know, that was a prevailing attitude. So if you did go from movies to television, it was considered a sign that your career was in trouble, because A, you can't make it in the movies, why not do a last-ditch thing and try television? It's better to go on the stage if you couldn't make it in movies. But and you know, likewise, also unusual for a TV star to make the jump to movies, because a lot of producers would take some convincing that you could be marketable in a movie. Then, you know, there were some exceptions, but they were unusual. It's not like today where, you know, I've been seeing a lot of the recent summer movies on DVD lately, and it's like every other movie I'm going, oh, hey, that guy's from Lost, that guy's from The Wire. That didn't used to happen. So, you know, the stigma is more or less gone away, to the point where now we have three CSI shows and the leads in each one of them are movie people. And Kiefer Sutherland is doing 24 and Charlie Sheen's doing a sitcom, and nobody really thinks about that. But at one time, any one of those things would have been, you know, big water cooler talk and had significant ramifications on their careers.
Yeah, I mean, even if you think back as recently as it was, if you were a TV actor who tried to jump into the movies, it was considered you shouldn't be leaving a successful series to go into the movies because you're not going to make it, right? Whereas now there seems to be way more crossover. If you think of, like, when Shelley Long left Cheers to make those terrible 80s comedies and then disappear forever, and was like, well, that was a terrible career decision on her part. Why would she not have stuck with this, you know, super popular sitcom that ran for 13 years or whatever? But now it does seem like a lot of people, like you say, they shoot TV and then during the summer hiatus, they go do a couple movies or whatever, and people just kind of move back and forth. And not just actors, too, but people on the other end of the creative side, right? There's a new show this year called Flash Forward, which is created by David S. Goyer, who's one of the screenwriters of the new Batman movies and a bunch of he's a, you know, pretty successful screenwriter. You have guys like Quentin Tarantino constantly dabbling around directing TV shows or acting in them or whatever. So it's not just necessarily actors, too. People on the other side of the lens have been getting into it more and more.
Yeah, and so television was largely unchanged for a long time, decade after decade. You know, maybe the stories would be a little different, they'd look a little different, but they'd be produced the same way and still have...
Yeah, right, you had the half-hour, three-camera sitcom, and you had your hour-long dramas about cops or doctors or cops or doctors, and that was pretty much it.
Yeah,
at least we should be clear, we're really mainly talking about American television here. I think other countries had a less rigid system, for instance, but over here in America, man, TV was very, very, very formulaic for a very long time.
So in other words, you can have some great entertainment now and again, but it was a very difficult medium to have great art in.
Yeah. Even if you look at some of the shows that were considered very progressive at the time, you think of like the Norman Lear sitcoms in the 70s, stuff like All in the Family. They're very sort of socially progressive and controversial. When you watch them now, they're clearly, well, one, they all come off a little dated, but two, they're clearly following a very rigid sitcom format setup. Punchline, characters that don't change. So even though, you could have good entertainment, you could even have, you know, interesting things to think about, it was very much, you're going to get these 22 minutes of jokes with some commercials in between, and then we're going to move on.
And, you know, if you muted the dialogue and maybe imagined different fashions and hairstyles, you couldn't tell the difference between, a 50s sitcom and an 80s sitcom.
Yeah.
But there were some great things that happened during this time on television, and like Steven said, it was mostly in other countries, and you know, I want to just talk a little bit about them. We should mention Kieslowski's The Decalogue, which we mentioned either an episode or two ago, but that was a series of 10 one-hour short films, and it was aired as a television series, a short television series, and these are great movies. Very smart, deal with some real morally difficult life situations, real strong characters, realistic characters, and some heartbreaking situations, some happy situations, but, you know, real life kind of stuff, and it's heavy hitting. These are great things. And then Ingmar Bergman was very active on television. He's known for his movies, but what some people don't realize is that some of his really great movies, like Scenes from a Marriage and Fanny and Alexander, the preferred director's cuts of those were the television airings. They, you know, Scenes from a Marriage, well, actually both of those movies are about 3 hours long in the theatrical cut and about six on television. They'd air like a miniseries. And so you have this truly great director doing some of his finest work on television. He did a lot of other things too. In this country, not so much of that. What you'd see more likely is that you'd see some great film directors getting their starts in television. Robert Altman, Sidney Lumet, Steven Spielberg all started in television. You know, Spielberg, one of his first movies was an episode of Columbo. definitely not where you'd think the future director of things like Schindler's List and Raiders of the Lost Ark would come from. And he also made a movie, made-for-TV movie called Duel in 1971 that is regarded so highly that it's an honorary theatrical movie. Nobody says, oh, that's just a TV movie. That's good enough to be a theatrical movie. Really, really tense and taut thriller that, you know, it's low budget, but you can do a lot with little money if you are a great filmmaker.
Yeah, and Duel is awesome. And yeah, I think what you said earlier about people, you know, not wanting to get out of TV and into the movies is true, and directors kind of had to go back to TV sometimes, like, as a punishment. Like, Altman, when he was on his weird sort of, I don't know, post-Popeye decline in the 80s, went back and did stuff for TV again. Though, with Altman, it's always hard to tell. I don't know if he viewed it as a punishment, but, you know, people weren't going to give him a lot of money to make big-budget Hollywood movies at the time, so he moved back into TV. And we should talk about Michael Mann, kind of did the same thing. He had a couple of not huge successes and made a little show called Miami Vice, which was a huge hit, even though if you watch that show today, boy, is it dated.
Yeah, viewed today, it's like a parody of the 80s. It's not just the 80s. It's like exaggerated 80s.
It is. It's if you haven't seen Miami Vice, it's the story of two cops in the Vice Squad in Miami chasing down drug dealers and going at clubs and wearing insane clothing. You know, it's always some sort of weird powder pink or powder blue or whatever. But it does have a very Michael Mann feel to it. And it's got a lot of the Mann trademarks. It's about crime. It's in, you know, it's got that kind of cool feel. And in fact, it's sort of an important show in that it, you know, Michael Mann was a great director by that time. He'd made Thief, which is just freaking awesome. And he moves into the TV and kind of helps create this TV show and establishes the look of it. And Miami Vice had a very sort of crazy energy to it that was very much of the Michael Mann high energy, high cool, high style vibe. It's still a TV show, but I think maybe it helped bring the sense that you could bring more of a movie sensibility to television drama, even though it definitely fell squarely into the cop drama formula. And, yeah, I guess we kind of both, Sam and I, agree that American TV, at least, didn't really change a whole lot from, say, 1960 to really sometime in the late 90s. It was kind of more or less the same, like we said earlier. You had your sitcoms, and you had your dramas, and every now and then you got some interesting kinds of shows. In terms of other directors moving to TV, also worth mentioning probably David Lynch, who created a short-lived series called Twin Peaks in the early 90s, which has a real cult following. It is a very, very much David Lynch kind of movie. If you watched it all back to back, you could definitely think you were watching a David Lynch movie. And also much like a David Lynch movie, it has a terrible, terrible stretch that's horrible. And then it gets good again at the end, randomly.
Yeah. You ruined my joke. I was going to say, and then he went on to become one of your favorite film directors. But you preempted that joke.
Yeah. Sorry. Well, yeah, Twin Peaks, which ran for two seasons, the second of which is not particularly good, it's really interesting because it really looks like a David Lynch movie, and it's very much a serial television show, which is interesting. You can't watch the middle episode in the series and kind of have an idea of what's going on, though it was really hampered by the fact that the network, ABC, really wanted more of a traditional kind of mystery show and kind of compromised it, and that's sort of why it gets bad. But it was always designed to be a serialized story, drawing a lot from, say, soap operas, which I guess is another TV genre that's existed since just about the birth of the medium.
Oh, yeah, since the early 50s. And I was reading the other day, so some of the longest-running shows ever are soap operas. I guess that's not surprising. The other ones are news shows, you know, whatever nightly news on whatever network. But yeah, the longest running soap operas have run for over 10,000 episodes.
Wow.
This is weird because this is a serial story, and I suspect that no one on the planet has seen the whole thing. What is up? I don't have a lot of patience with soaps, but that's an aside. Go ahead and what you were saying.
Well, I think the soaps are kind of interesting because they show that TV could be used to tell serial long form storylines, but sort of the problem with them is because they run forever and they have no end, and actors come and go and characters come and go. They had this really unfocused, we're making up as we go along feeling to them.
I wonder why. Maybe they were making it up as they went along.
That's right. And so what David Lynch and his co-creator of Twin Peaks, Mark Frost, were kind of doing was taking that kind of drama and trying to build, well, traditional for David Lynch anyway, storylines. And it didn't quite work. The show really, it only did not get good in the second season, or it got pretty bad. The viewership really declined. People really just weren't able to keep up with the show. If you missed an episode, it was impossible to ever really get caught up with it because it was so weird and complex, and it was canceled. But I think it paved the way for a lot of other shows. And during the 90s, we saw, I don't know exactly what to call it, but we saw these shows with complex mythologies being built and interspersed with random episode of the week type episodes. I'm thinking of shows here like The X-Files or the Buffy the Vampire Slayer TV series. These are two shows that had this sort of formula to them. You know, they could have an episode that wasn't connected to a larger storyline, but then also have a lot of episodes that were connected to a much larger mythology, and they had season-long plot arcs. Which is interesting because one of the challenges for TV is the traditional way you make money off television shows is, sure, the first run of it, but then also what's called syndication, which is basically where once a show has had a certain number of episodes, it's usually around 100 episodes, you sell it to other networks. So maybe the show is airing in prime time in the evening on ABC, but after five or six seasons, ABC packages it, or the company that owns the show packages it and sells it, and then anyone who wants to can buy it and, like, say, air the earlier episodes in the middle of the day or, you know, in the evening before prime time. And Sam and I, both growing up, I think we've seen a ton of I Love Lucy between us, and we certainly weren't alive when it was airing, right? We saw reruns because that's a show that's been in syndication.
I'm a bit older than you. I was. I don't know if
you were alive when
I'm like 75.
Okay.
People not know that.
I know. Excellent.
I just had a quick comment. You're talking about the start of serialized television, but serialized in a way that some of the episodes were standalone stories. And I just want to say that this is sort of what The Prisoner and The Fugitive did a lot earlier.
Yeah, I should have mentioned The Prisoner.
The idea of The Prisoner was, you know, hey, this guy is trapped, he's got to escape from this thing. The Fugitive was, well, the one-armed man killed this guy's wife and he's got to go find him. But along the way, there would be individual stories. So it's kind of taking that tradition and extending it a bit.
Absolutely.
The serialization wasn't entirely the province of soap opera.
That's true. And The Prisoner is actually probably a really good example of where TV was kind of going, because that's a very short, compact story that has an ending. I don't know if anyone understands that ending, but it has one. And if you watch the show, it does kind of feel like they had some idea where they were going. Whereas if you watch The Fugitive, I don't know if they really knew where they were going. They were just going to do it for as long as they could until they got canceled, which is sort of how TV went. And then I guess there's sort of a turning point at some point, and I'm going to go ahead and place that turning point at 1999 when HBO, which is a pay network here in America, which means for a variety of reasons it has a completely different operating model than all the other TV networks, and there's a couple of these channels that you have to spend extra money to get. They're only on cable, and you got to subscribe to them. They cost a monthly fee. And so they don't have commercials because you have to pay for them, which is interesting. And also they have much looser restrictions on what kind of content they can show. So, you know, on HBO they show more or less uncensored R-rated movies and stuff with nudity and violence and swearing, things that you wouldn't see even on what we call basic cable here in America, and certainly would never see on network television, which is actually regulated and censored by the government. So complex rules regarding what can get shown where in America, some legal, some not. basically, HBO had been experimenting with TV shows for a long time, but mainly they were a movie channel and still are. And they had some other previous shows that no one really cared about that much. Some good comedies and stuff, but really nothing worthwhile talking about here. And then they put on The Sopranos, which became a huge hit. And The Sopranos really represents a pretty serious change in television drama in that it really feels like a movie. In fact, it deliberately apes a movie like Goodfellas and, to a lesser extent, The Godfather series. It's got a crazy, frantic energy that feels like Scorsese made it. It has half of Goodfellas cast, which I think helps that feeling. And it gives us this really strange, complex protagonist, this guy Tony Soprano, who is this mobster in Jersey, and it's about him trying to balance his personal family life with his business life, you know, business being running a mob family. And he is a bad guy. He's not a nice guy at all. He's a murderer and a ruthless killer and an extortionist and all these terrible things, and he cheats on his wife, but he's the star of the show, and he's somewhat sympathetic, even though he's this. The show does not really pull any punches. It doesn't try to make him a lovable character. In fact, in the later seasons, it maybe even goes too far because audiences started liking him, and I think the creators wanted to remind you from time to time, no, he's a horrible person. You really shouldn't like him. But he was very interesting, and this is the kind of thing that you wouldn't have seen before on television, because TV was supposed to be sort of comforting and fun, and here is this really complex, morally dirty show that says here is a main character who is this bad person, and you're going to kind of root for him, and we're going to deliberately make you question why you're doing that. And more than that, it says this is going to be a serial show, so if you come in halfway through the season, we're not going to stop and explain to you what's going on all the time. You're going to be expected that you kind of have to watch from the start. And it's a very complicated show. The very first episode introduces all these characters, and it doesn't really explain all their relationships necessarily. It does to some degree, but you're really expected to pay attention. And there are these long stories. Each season is, to a large degree, a somewhat independent story. The kind of basic formula in each season is Tony's got some kind of problem, some challenge to his authority, or the feds are investigating him or something, and he has to figure out a way to deal with it. And usually, by the end of the season, we see a resolution to it, especially the first three seasons. The show got a little wandering in the last three and a half seasons, but the first couple ones very much were focused on these season-long story arcs.
You know what's funny about that is you think of the artists as being progressive and wanting to try to do new things all the time, and you think of the studio executives or the network executives as being, hey, we only want what's already been successful because then we'll be successful too. I was watching an interview with David Chase, and that's on one of the DVDs for The Sopranos, and he was talking about how the network executives were more interested in the overall season arc. You know, that, hey, what's the story that goes across the whole 13 episodes? And David Chase wanted to make 13 little movies. So he was more, I mean, he definitely was interested in having it serialized, but he was more interested in the episode-long story arcs, at least for the first season. There's a balance there, but I thought it was pretty interesting that the artist and who is creating this hugely progressive show is more personally interested by the elements that had already been done in television.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I mean, HBO at that time was deliberately trying to do something different. They were like looking for kind of a new identity. And that's how they sort of greenlit that show. And they'd made some other. There was a show called Oz on at the time, which is just the most ridiculously graphically disgusting, violent show. It's not necessarily a bad show. It's clearly they were just trying to push people's buttons. And so I think, you know, that makes sense at that particular time why HBO would want to be more something fresh and interesting, maybe even than David Chase was looking to do.
I think the real inspiration for what makes The Sopranos successful and why it became a model for so many other serial shows afterwards is that the season arc is its own story. It's not the series. It's not for 6 years that this one story is going to go on. In 13 episodes, or if you're on network television, maybe 22, 23 episodes, you're going to get a whole story, and then next year you'll get another one. You won't have to remember quite so much. And that, I don't know that it had been really done before, but it was a stroke of inspiration, I think, because you go too long, it's just too long and unwieldy, and probably you're drawing it out longer than the story naturally should be. But you know, if you go with a season arc to represent a book, and then maybe it's a trilogy, and there's, you know, there's multiple books. But if you have a resolution at the end of the year, you can be satisfied about that and think, hey, I was told a complex story and it ended, and I'm satisfied by that. That was a real stroke of inspiration, and I think that's largely why it was as successful as it was and popular.
Yeah, and it helps also. We shouldn't discount the fact that it's great. It's really well written. It's well acted, put together wonderfully, and it's entertaining. I mean, it's a lot like Goodfellas. So if you like Goodfellas, you can pretty easily like The Sopranos. It's got the same kind of dark humor to it. It's got the same kind of energy and the same kind of interesting but flawed characters.
And you know what's great? The characters in The Sopranos are fans of Goodfellas too.
Yeah.
They're always quoting it and The Godfather. And, you know. So that's another tie with the movies that's kind of fun.
One of the other interesting things that The Sopranos does that will be a model to, I think, other shows and other dramas is we talked about how there were other shows that maybe were socially conscious or that try to tell longer form stories within the confines of their formula. The Sopranos very deliberately tries to have something more to say. And it's not really a message show, so I don't want to make that kind of a claim. But The Sopranos is in a real specific sense trying to capture America at that time, right at the turn of the century, in a variety of ways. And it kind of deals indirectly with, a lot of times, the decline of, say, smaller neighborhoods and communities and businesses. And it kind of shows us the decline of the mafia as a metaphor for that change. There's a really great moment, maybe it's a little on the nose, but a really great moment in one of the later seasons where a couple of mobsters try to shake down a guy at like a corporate coffee chain, like a Starbucks. And they go into the manager and they say, like, you're new in the area, you got to pay us our money, our protection money. And he's like, I can't give you any money. I just work the register, right? I don't have any power to give you any kind of dough. And they're like, well, what would your corporation think if you disappeared? You know, maybe their manager got killed. And he'd be like, they'd send a new manager down. You know, they're not gonna pay you. And, you know, they kind of walk out, and they're like, wow, you know, the small businessman's really getting hurt here. And it's like, yeah, the mob can't shake down Starbucks. What are they going to do? You can't. The guy there can't give you anything, and you can't go to the president's house and harass him. He's got a private security detail. And so The Sopranos was really kind of about that. You know, one of the problems that Tony Soprano always faces, he feels like he came in at the end, like at the decline of something, which, you know, it's not a good something that's declining, but I think it's maybe something that a lot of people feel, that American society is in this kind of changing period, and The Sopranos caught it well. And now you also mentioned this notion that each season could be a concrete story, and I think that got taken even more to an extreme with The Wire, which began in 2002 on HBO, and the creator of that show deliberately tried to make each season like a novel. They referred to their show actually as a visual novel. It was created by two guys, a guy named David Simon and a guy named Ed Burns. Ed Burns, not the filmmaker of the similar name, by the way. So David Simon was previously a crime reporter for the Baltimore Sun, and Burns was a homicide cop for a number of years, and later a school teacher in Baltimore. And David Simon had actually written a book in the late 80s or the early 90s called Homicide, A Year on the Killing Streets, about a year he spent basically riding around and shadowing homicide detectives in Baltimore. That actually got turned into a television show in 1993 called Homicide, Life onto the Street. That show was created by Barry Levinson, which is an interesting bit of a filmmaker coming to work in television. He kind of directed the first episode and set the look of it. And Homicide was an interesting network drama that no one ever really watched. And by its later seasons, it got turned into a typical cop show and was terrible. But the first two seasons especially, were a very kind of documentary-esque feel of cops working in the homicide unit. Didn't have any chases or shootouts, and it would take several episodes for them to solve crimes often, which was kind of interesting. And most cop shows previous to that point, like a Dragnet or a Law and Order or whatever, they solve the crime within an hour always. Maybe sometimes there's a special two-parter, but on Homicide, a crime might be solved during the episode. It might go six episodes before they finally track down who did it. So it was very interesting in that regard. And David Simon, toward the end of that show, actually became a writer on it, learned the ropes in television. And actually in 2000 for HBO, along with Ed Burns, wrote and produced a miniseries called The Corner, which was about basically this family of people who had been affected by drugs in Baltimore. And they kind of expanded on that same sort of idea with the show The Wire in 2002, which is just a transcendent show in so many ways. The basic setup makes it really sound like a traditional network cop show, but it's so far from it. Basically, the first season follows this special unit of detectives in Baltimore who are trying to track down this drug dealer, and the show kind of splits time between what the cops are doing and what a number of the people in the drug gang are doing. And it's really interesting in that everyone in the show, just about, is a very, very well-developed character. We spend a lot of time with everyone, and it gives us a fairly equal treatment of both sides. And again, I don't mean to say that it's not arguing that the drug dealers are good people. In fact, many of them are evil and are pretty despicable, but it makes them into fully dimensional characters, so we understand why they do what they do, and we see that actually some of them aren't really evil, but they've made some bad decisions, and here they are kind of stuck in this life. But more than that, each season is very, very specifically a single story, whereas, like you said, Sam, the Sopranos has episodes, and David Chase was always interested in the story for a given episode. You can't watch a single episode of The Wire and get much out of it, really. There's no beginning, middle, and conclusion to an episode of The Wire. These are like chapters out of a novel. If you read the first chapter of a novel, you wouldn't expect to get any kind of resolution, and you'd never get that out of an episode of The Wire until the final episode of the season, or really actually the final maybe two or three episodes of the season when everything kind of gets wrapped up. And so, actually, through the course of five seasons, they looked at a number of different things, often with the same characters, but by the end, they had this huge, complex cast of characters. Season two actually focuses on dock workers in Baltimore, which was a pretty radical shift from cops and drug dealers. Season three focuses on city politics. Season four is about the school system, and a really clever idea to follow four children through the system, and actually we see how they interact with all these other people that we've known. And then season five is about the media, focusing particularly on the Baltimore Sun, where obviously David Simon used to work.
And that's amazing, because by the end of the show, you have a really complete picture of a whole city and all the complex interactions. And that's what I love about that show, is it shows how connected everything is. This druggie on the street, no real value to anybody, you know, with any kind of important position in the city. But something happens to him, and he gets angry, and he offends the wrong person, and suddenly he's got the attention of the mayor. And we see exactly how that event trickled up the chain of command and sideways and all through the city. You know, it's great because it's completely convincing in that, too. It's not just this little cute idea, oh, what if the butterfly's wings blew the little air and then this changed and this changed. No, it's absolutely logical and convincing and plausible.
Yeah, and it's a show that really, because it takes its time to tell stories and it isn't interested in delivering, at the end of the hour, any kind of satisfaction sometimes, it can really take its time to show us things. I mean, I feel like I learned a lot about police work from watching The Wire. You know, if I don't know if I learned anything about police work from watching some of the other cop shows. You know, I don't think Starsky and Hutch teaches anyone how to be a detective. But The Wire kind of gives you an idea of how detectives work, what their days are like.
And it's worth noting, too, the background that the show's writers have, because this isn't just some writers imagining the world of the detective. You know more about that than I do. I mean, David Simon and Ed Burns both have experience in the situations that the show covers.
Absolutely. I mean, like I said, Simon was a crime reporter for a number of years, spent a year working on a book following them around, and Burns was a cop for more than 20 years himself. And in fact, some of the other writers they had on the show, they had like Dennis Lehane, who wrote stuff like Mystic River and Gone Baby Gone, which we've talked about the movies, the novelist George Pelicanos. I mean, some of the more celebrated crime novelists writing novels today in America became writers on this show after the first and second seasons because it was such a phenomenal show. So,
and didn't Ed Burns have some teaching background too, or something to do
with
schools?
Yeah, he served as a teacher after he was a homicide detective.
And that was the best season of the show too, the school one.
Absolutely. In fact, that was something I know David Simon was always he always insisted that they have experience before they wrote about something. They actually had an idea for a sixth season of the show, which would have been about the Hispanic population in Baltimore and how that's changed the city. But the fact was, no one on the writing staff at the time really spoke Spanish. None of them knew that world, and Simon didn't want to try to do it unless it was going to be completely and totally authentic. So they decided that after five seasons, it was a time to wrap up.
We should mention, by the way, for people who are not familiar with HBO shows in general, I mean, when Steven says authentic, it is authentic. This is, it would have to be cut down to be an R rating in the theater. There's nothing gratuitous in it, but you do get an unflinching look at real life. It is very violent. It is sexual. There is a lot of language that, it, you know, that's the way people talk in these worlds. So, you know, just, if you're not familiar with cable shows, you're familiar with your you know, CSIs and so forth. This is not that.
Yeah, the CSI, man, that's pretty grisly sometimes.
Well, that's true. That's true. That's not an innocent show.
There's no violence in the wire. That's as bad as CSI, I don't think.
Don't say a swear word, but we can show you this cadaver that's been sliced open and decaying, and yeah, there's a strange situation where violence is somehow socially acceptable now, but the other things are not.
Yeah, it is a little creepy. I guess the thing with The Wire, though, is the violence hurts so much more because we care about the victims so often.
Yeah. And you know that there are real people like that in the world. It's not just a character. These are, you know, they're not true stories, but they're representative of the lives of a lot of people.
Absolutely. And many of the characters in the show are based fairly closely on real people or are kind of composites of a couple different people. And it is willing, something else that we've seen as a sort of trend in television is the willingness to kill off characters, and both The Sopranos and The Wire have this in spades, where characters you really like can die. And this was something that didn't used to happen on TV because, again, well, it was kind of about just having an enjoyable escapist kind of hour or half hour and making it into syndication, and it doesn't work if a character gets killed off. It would happen from time to time, but it was always a big deal when it did.
And it was usually always because the actor wanted to leave the show.
Correct.
Or he made some executive angry, so, hey, we'll kill you off. But, you know, in these shows, the character gets killed off because that's how the story goes.
Yeah, and especially in The Wire, which, I mean, the first three seasons of The Wire have, they don't really have a main character, but there's a particular homicide detective who is sort of the protagonist of the first couple of seasons. He sets a lot of it in motion. In the fourth season, he doesn't get killed or anything, but he's not really in it. He shows up from time to time, but it's not about him that season. And that's like a pretty bold move that I can't imagine most other TV shows would have done, to take you're probably one of the most popular characters in the show, and certainly one of the main characters in the first three, and be like, well, no, you're not. You know that you're not needed. We'll get you'll kind of pop in, and we'll have you back in season five. But for right now, we're telling a different story. So, and then, yeah, I guess this is part of just an explosion of shows, really, since The Sopranos, that have been pushing boundaries and doing interesting things. A lot of them on cable at first. You know, we had The Wire in 2002. The Shield on FX in 2002 as well, as another cop show. It's about as different from The Wire as it could get, but it's another, I'm not a huge fan, but a lot of people really like it. Another really dark protagonist, the main character in the very first episode, kills deliberately another undercover cop because the main character of the show is this dirty cop and he's being investigated, and you know, he kills a perfectly good, innocent cop to protect himself, and that's how the show begins. And we also started seeing on television, pretty soon after The Sopranos, on network television, I should say, more interesting, complex
shows. Before you get into there, if we're going to talk about network television, we got to rewind a little bit, because what we're seeing, like, overall, we're painting a picture of how TV is becoming more like movies. And, you know, these cable shows we were talking about, they're really long movies spread out into hour-long segments. But on network television, although this is not happening, we should mention that the look of television is changing.
Oh, absolutely.
A little bit before this time. In the 90s, ER, NYPD Blue, you start seeing the cinematography and the production values getting to a more movie-like look, a filmic look, to use a snobby term. and also widescreen. TV shows are starting to become widescreen. I remember when ER first did that. It was like, well, widescreen, why are you doing that? Our TVs are not widescreen. Well, it turned out to be a really good move.
Yeah.
So we're not seeing the storylines necessarily evolving as quickly as they did on cable, but the look, we were starting to get away from the television look that had been, you know, that way for 50 years in the late 90s.
That's a good point. And, you know, a show like CSI, which we mentioned earlier, the subject matter is pretty, you know, you wouldn't have found that subject matter on in the 60s. But otherwise, the show's a pretty standard kind of police procedural drama. Except that it looks like a movie. I mean, the production values are amazing. It's got, you know, crazy looks, it kind of washed out, weird filters. Looks like, you know, maybe Soderbergh.
Yeah, and they experiment with long tracking shots, and you know, and ER did a live episode, which is not like movies, so it's actually going back to the beginning of TV, but it shows how there's started to be some more creativity in the way shows were produced.
Yeah, and again, it's interesting you mentioned the shift to widescreen. Well, we remember back at the start of the podcast, we mentioned widescreen was a shift the movies made to make themselves less like TV. Well, TVs are deliberately trying to become more like the movies, and that's, you know, one of the most concrete examples of it. So why do we think this shift has happened, though? We sort of kind of cataloged the history of what happened, but why this change? I guess I have a couple guesses here. Obviously, part of it is because people are copying the success HBO had with not just The Sopranos, but other shows that they did after that, especially in the drama department, like Deadwood or Rome, which were these very adult, in both those cases, expensive period pieces, which is why they both got canceled, actually. They were too expensive, despite being very popular, which is an oddity that TV sometimes runs into. But another reason, I think, is that the way we watch television has really, really changed. One of the reasons that TV is now willing to be more experimental is because it's really hurting, and not just before, you know, the recent economic downturn. TV viewership has been dropping off like crazy since the 90s, to the point where shows basically that got canceled, you know, 10 years ago would be good-sized hits today, just if they got the same number of eyeballs watching, or especially the same percentage of people. There are way more channels, especially here in the U.S., and I assume elsewhere in the world, too. You know, we used to joke, oh, we got 500 channels and nothing on. I think I literally have 500 channels now. Like, that's not an exaggeration. I probably have 500 different channels. Plus, I have the internet, and with the internet, I've got Netflix, so I can, you know, get four different movies or whatever I want anytime I want it. I can stream stuff. So TV's got more competition for eyeballs, which means it's had to kind of change. It used to be, like we talked about, we were trying to be a big hit, especially when there are only three networks, right? So the entire country's watching one of three channels, basically. You had to make shows that had broad appeal, because, you know, what are you going to do? You can't play to a niche audience. That's eyeballs you're just wasting that you would otherwise have. And also because, you know, we're going to make all this money from syndication, because there are only a couple of different channels and they had to fill that time 24/7. You know, they're going to run my reruns and I'll make a ton of money. Well, that's becoming less and less the thing. I don't want to sit around watching reruns anymore. Because the other way that watching TV has changed is we watch it when we want to watch it now. I'm not stuck just watching what happens to be airing at a given time. I've got a DVR, and I can go ahead and tape everything that airs automatically. I remember back in the day screwing around with the VHS timer and trying to record it to program stuff, and I'm a pretty technical guy, but I think I was always at best, you know, 75% chance it would actually record what I wanted it to record. You know, unless you were there to actually press record and hit stop, it always seemed a little bit sketchy. I don't know what's going on. And, you know, people who weren't technical could never figure it out. But now with the DVRs and the TiVo and stuff, you just have it automatically record the show whenever it shows up. You don't have to worry about when it's on, which is nice. And, of course, DVDs are great. I mean, how many of these shows that we're going to talk about or have talked about, Sam, have we watched on DVD rather than television?
Oh, I've watched almost all of them on DVDs, and I prefer that way.
Yeah, me too.
You know, you can watch them on your own. You can watch them at the rate you want to. And you have these season-long story arcs that, you know, you got to wait week to week. And, you know, 12 weeks in, you forget what's happened a lot of times. So, you know, sometimes, I mean, some shows do play better with breaks. I've noticed that a couple do. They do work better on a weekly schedule. But then others just, they're inherently better viewing experiences if you watch them all back-to-back in a row.
Yeah, I mean, The Wire is a great example. If you're going to watch The Wire, I mean, it's designed to be a novel with different chapters. Are you going to read one chapter of a novel a week? I mean, maybe, but if it's a really good novel, I'm going to sit there, I'm going to just read it over the weekend, right? I'm not going to just stop and wait 1 week between chapters if I want to find out what's going to happen next.
And so that in itself is a shift toward television that's more movie-like. You know, you're just watching a 13-hour movie or a 24-hour movie or something.
Exactly. And it's kind of nice. So you kind of have that control that you didn't used to have. And I think what you said about forgetting what happened, I mean, I know that, you know, Lost is a show that we both like, but when they used to have the 24-episode seasons, or whatever it was, the first couple seasons, like, and they would have gaps between them, and, you know, during the Christmas break, you have to wait a month to see the next episode, I would have real trouble remembering what was going on. I have, like, you know, go on the internet and read the recap to remember exactly what all... I'm like, oh, yeah, that... And that's a really complicated show.
Lost is very complicated. In fact, this is a good lead-in to talk about that in the first place, you know, because we talked about some serialized cable shows and some movie-like cinematography on the networks, but then the networks really started trying to copy the season-long serial shows as well. So you have 24... which is a great spy thriller type of thing where it takes place in real time. There's 24 episodes in the season, and each hour-long episode in the show is an hour-long in the story, and the guy basically has to stay awake for 24 hours, and at the end of the 24 hours, then he's you know, there's a solution of some kind. But, yeah, that's a... love that show. Love it.
Do you still love it?
I still love it.
Really? I think the earlier seasons were definitely stronger.
I thought it got better. I thought each season got better until the fourth one.
Okay, that's fair enough. I didn't see the most recent season, but that's a show I think plays a lot better on DVD. Though it's kind of weird on DVD because 24 has a bunch of like kind of fake cliffhangers. With like, it's like, oh, someone's gonna die, and it's like, oh no, it was fine. It was nothing. and when you have to wait a week, it's kind of okay. When you watch it immediately, and I should say 24, like on DVD, is like crack.
Is 18? It's a 17 or 18.
But now. It's also like you can't just watch one episode. It's impossible.
Oh, I know. Darlene knows when I get 24 in the mail from Netflix the next 6 days or whatever. You know, I'm out of commission because you know I cannot watch one episode at a time. It's like I get a DVD, it has four episodes on it for the next 2.5 hours or however long 4 hours of television is when you take the commercials out. I'm watching that, and then the next night I plan it out so that, you know, the next one comes the next exact night because I don't want to wait an extra day.
No,
it's just so addicting. But I say this, you know, it's addicting, but by the time you get to the end of the season, I don't have to get the next season for, you know, whenever I want. But it just shows you how much of a great thriller it is. You know, if you're just on the edge of your seat for 18 hours.
Yeah. I always a little bit trouble with it because it gets kind of ridiculous toward the middle of the season usually. And I don't know why no one will ever listen to Jack Bauer despite his track record. But, it's definitely a fun show. I will grant that. And it's anchored by such a crazy, memorable character. I think maybe that's one of the other trends we've seen in television. I talked about The Sopranos, but... these really interesting protagonists that we've seen in the last decade on TV that we didn't have before, right?
Yeah.
I mean, Jack Bauer is a crazy cool protagonist.
And there's also a willingness to let the characters go to places that you'd never have them go. You never had an episode where Columbo develops a drug problem because
right.
he was undercover and he had to take drugs to keep his cover, and then the next episode would be about him being rehabilitated and, you know, his bosses being suspicious of his ability to carry out his... You know, you never had that stuff with Columbo. But there's a willingness to do some crazy things and, you know, like you say, kill off characters if the story requires it. So now you watch a show like 24 or Lost, and it's just that much more involving because you do not know that, hey, this character's safe or this is never going to happen. It'll happen.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, yeah, sometimes you will think there's no way that person's going to die, and then they do. And that's actually a really good thing to mention. Because I've always sort of, a lot of times you're watching a movie or a TV show and you know that character X cannot die, it kind of deflates some of the tension.
There was even a show, I guess we shouldn't mention which one, but there was a show that had a narrator and they killed the narrator off. It's like the whole show was narrated by this guy and now he's dead. Well, okay, whatever. So you can't rely on anything.
Exactly. Let's see, what other interesting protagonists we have? I think a very, very interesting protagonist is on House, which started in 2004, which is kind of a weird hybrid, wouldn't you say, between It's like a police procedural that happens to be a doctor show.
The creators of House actually were interested in making a Sherlock Holmes story in the guise of a medical drama. They wanted to have, you know, the house be like Sherlock Holmes, and he would detect the illness that was killing this person or whatever it was, and come out with these crazy but logical leaps of deduction to figure out the solution to the mystery. That was their whole goal. So yeah, that is interesting.
Right,
and what a character, though. I mean, that's got to be the most interesting character.
Certainly one of them. I'm not a huge fan of the show, but I like the character, and Hugh Laurie's performance is so fascinating. Actually, if they didn't have all the medical stuff, I'd probably watch it.
Mm. So Hugh Laurie, who's the actor who plays House, everybody's surprised when I say this, but he's British.
What?
If you see him in interviews, you didn't know that?
No, I did.
Yes, you did.
Yeah.
But that really throws people who don't know his work in Britain. He used to be half of a comedy team, if it can get even weirder on you. and he specialized in playing these really dumb characters, these gleefully ignorant people. And yeah, people are tripped out if they don't know his work in Britain, and I tell them he's British. There's actually a scene in House where the character House tries to do a British accent, and he does it badly. That is talent.
There's a similar gag in The Wire, too. The guy who played McNulty is British. Dominic West.
That's even weirder to me, because I didn't know he was British ahead of time, like I did with Hugh Laurie.
Yeah, and there's a similar scene in I think, season 2, where he's pretending to be a Brit, and everyone's making fun of his accent. Even weirder is that Stringer Bell, the guy, Idris Elba, who plays Stringer Bell on The Wire, who is this hardcore drug dealer character from the inner city, is also British. And if you hear him speak in his regular accent, it is a crazy trip.
Yeah. But it shows how good they both are at doing the American accent.
Absolutely.
Because accents in movies and TV shows are, you know, traditionally hilariously awful. If you've ever seen Murder, She Wrote, it's set in Maine. They should not have set it in Maine because nobody on the show could do a Maine accent. They're all awful. So, you know, it's a classic tradition in television to do bad accents.
And then there's one more show I definitely want to mention, which is currently airing. Some of these shows we talked about have been canceled. Obviously, Lost is about to go into its final season may even be airing by the time this podcast makes it out there. But there's one on AMC, which is another weird little cable channel that is famous for previously playing good movies and then deciding to reverse that strategy and play garbage movies all day long. They have a show called Mad Men, and it was a weird thing when everyone heard that AMC was producing an original series, and it was going to be about advertising executives in the 1960s. And I was like, what? And in fact, it was going to be written by one of the guys who wrote The Sopranos. And so it's about as big of a leap as you could get. But it turns out to be just an amazing, amazing show. Once again, we have a really complex drama with a large cast of characters. We have these long season arcs, though Mad Men tends to have kind of a less focused story than, you know, 24, obviously, or even The Sopranos or The Wire. Mad Men, it has a theme usually for a season, and a season tends to cover a specific period of time, like a year in the characters' lives, but there's no... Often, the overarching story is much more subdued in the background. It tends to just be a straight drama, but somehow it manages to avoid becoming just pure soap opera, I think because of very skillful writing that seems like very real characters and not just plot twists for the sake of having plot twists. And also probably the most gorgeous TV show I've ever seen in my life. Just the production and the design of it is stunning. I couldn't tell the difference between Mad Men and a great feature film, I don't think, if I were just looking at it.
Yeah, it is. The look is great. One of the great things about Mad Men that I like is its ability to recapture the time. The first season is set in 1960, and it's tough to do like a period piece in recent history. You can do a period piece of the Victorian era. Nobody alive today lived there, so whatever you make up, you can present as authentic. If it looks like it could be authentic, then, you know, it doesn't have to be accurate. And you do 1960, you have to get it right, or people will call you on it. The other thing is, you can also do it right and still look like you are trying to recapture an era.
Yeah.
And it looks like a show that was made in the future, but is reflecting back on this. Mad Men never does. It looks like a show that would have been made in 1960, except that some of the content you wouldn't have gotten away with in 1960, but it feels like an authentic 1960, and the characters don't really know. Like, sometimes you get a sense that the actors or the characters, or the story at least, knows what the future is like and is adjusting itself to accentuate the time period that it's portraying, but this really looks like 1960 to me.
Yeah, and what it looks like a 1960 movie more than a 1960 TV show.
Yeah, this is Douglas Sirk, right?
Yeah, it's Douglas Sirk, or...
It reminds me of Far From Heaven.
I was going to actually make that comparison, too. I agree. It's a very good one. And that Far From Heaven, a little more of the Douglas Sirk sort of sentimentality and amped-up emotions. Mad Men is much more subdued, right?
Yeah.
Actually, Mad Men, they've referenced it a couple times on the show. It reminds me a lot of Billy Wilder's The Apartment.
Oh, yeah.
The content's different, but it's the same sort of people in a corporate setting, how that setting changes them, and sort of corporate politics, and also the sort of... I don't know, the sense of what am I doing here? What am I doing with my life that The Apartment has?
Yeah, and it's definitely a workplace from that time. You know, there's not the stigma of office romances between boss and secretary, for example. You know, some of the characters have affairs. Actually, they all have affairs, which is actually one of the problems I have with the show. It's kind of saying that, you know, everybody in the 1960s had affairs or was okay with it, and there was never any moral questions that, you know... Individuals would have had different ideas, and that's one thing I don't like about it. But
well, to be fair, I mean, you get a little certainly. Harry Crane has an affair and feels terrible about it.
But even so, it's like that's like the one part of the show where I sense that it is a reflection on 1960 than genuine 1960.
Yeah, no, I think in fact a lot of people have kind of called in the question its portrayal of gender and racial politics as being a little too over the top sometimes, which I think is probably fair.
Yeah.
There's a really bad scene, unfortunately, in season 3 that's like just trying way too hard between one of the advertising guys and the black elevator operator, in which the advertising guy is trying to figure out why black people are buying a specific brand of television more than white people. And, you know, the black guy's like, I don't got time for TV. I'm too busy with all the social change. I mean, that's not quite that bad. But and, you know, that received a lot of criticism.
There's a great scene, though. This one might be a little bit too knowing as well, but I did like it because it says a lot in a very little amount of time. But there's a scene in season 1 where a couple of women are at the mirror in the bathroom, in a public bathroom somewhere, and they're fixing their makeup or whatever. And the attendant, who's a black woman, says, you know, excuse me, there are ladies waiting to use the mirror. Well, first of all, why would they do that? But then what happens is that, okay, then the two women leave, and the attendant looks after them and says, you know, if they stop tipping, you know, how are we supposed to make a living? You know, well, what happened is you don't have bathroom attendants anymore.
Right.
So, you know, this is a very little minimalistic kind of scene, but, boy, it covers a wide range of social change.
Yeah, it's really well done, Sean. And again, we need to mention the protagonist a little bit. Another dark, complex main character at its core. And even after 3 seasons, I don't know if we're supposed to like him or not. He's gotten admirable qualities and really terrible qualities, and I guess we're supposed to like him, but, you know, dislike some of the stuff that he does, which is a very interesting way to watch TV, much more like a complex character in a movie or a novel.
Yeah. There is another show I want to talk about, and that would be a show on Showtime, and that's called Dexter. And the reason it's interesting is because, well, it took me a lot of convincing to watch it in the first place, because you hear the synopsis of what it's about, and it does not sound like a show you'd ever want to watch, or at least, you know, not one I'd want to watch. So I'll give you that synopsis and turn you off from the idea. The main character, Dexter Morgan, is a serial killer. He's a psychopath. He cannot empathize with others. He doesn't feel normal emotions. And he has this, you know, sick, twisted compulsion to kill. And the show is all about him. So you want to run right out and watch that, right? you know, even after a couple episodes of watching it, I was, in fact, I quit. I said, "Steven, does it get better?" And he said, "Well, yeah." And so, okay, I watched another couple episodes and then was hooked since. So, you know, it takes a bit to get into. But the show is about him trying to pretend to be a normal person and live a normal life while secretly feeding his addiction to killing. And, you know, the catch, though, is that his father... who is dead before the show begins, but he's a character on the show in flashbacks. His father recognized these compulsions that he had to kill, like animals and stuff, and he knew that eventually he's going to move on to people, and he taught him to only kill bad guys, other killers who escaped legal justice. You know, track them down and kill them, and you know, that way you're not going to hurt other people, and you're also not going to get caught, because you're less likely to get caught if you're smart about how you go about it. So this guy only kills bad guys, and, you know, not for traditional moral reasons, but because he has this code that he was taught to live by. So, as I said, not something that sounds like a good show, but it's weird. You find yourself caring about and empathizing with this character who is not able to empathize, and he doesn't care, but you care about him. And, you know, he does some really horrible things and has some really horrible impulses, and the show does not try to water that down. But why is it good, and it's a huge hit? Why do people like it? I have a theory about that.
All right, what's that?
Okay. My theory is that as creepy as the character is, as outrageous as he is and distasteful, basically you can identify with him because... Everybody, I don't care who you are, everybody has some kind of a dark secret. You know, it's probably not going to be as dramatic. Hopefully it's not that you kill people. you know, but there's something that you're ashamed about, something you know is wrong, or at least if you're honest with yourself, you do. You don't want anybody to find out about certain parts of your life for fear of embarrassment or judgment or people thinking less of you. I don't care who you are, there's something like that. So you live a different kind of life on the outside. You know, maybe it's not that different, but it's a life that does not include these things. And that's the face you show to the world. Well, you know, that's Dexter. The difference is his secret is, you know, a little more dramatic than hopefully ours are. So we can identify with him, but there's more to it than that. Because the show doesn't just portray this dark secret, it also twists it around and, you know, turns it into almost a good thing. You know, the people he kills are bad. They are horrible. So, you know, if he only kills them, you know, he's doing a bad thing, but sort of improving society, maybe you could, you know, you got to think about it. You can't just completely dismiss what he's doing. And, you know, wouldn't we all like to fantasize that our own secrets are not so bad after all and might even be good things? We play that game all the time because it's easier to define our moral codes by what we do instead of the other way around. So, you know, in that sense, I think the show is almost being, you know, a little bit dangerous here. It's playing with a dangerous idea, but I do love it for being as perceptive as it is about human nature and, you know, forcing its viewers to think about and deal with moral complexity. So, you know, it's compelling to me for those reasons.
Absolutely. And especially season two, which I think we can agree is the best of the seasons.
Two?
Yeah.
No, season one.
Oh, no, I'm sorry, you're wrong.
We're talking about Dexter.
Season two is still my favorite, but...
What are you talking about? You told me on email that it was weaker.
Did I?
Yeah.
I don't know. I guess I disagree with that now. Maybe I've changed my mind.
Now I'll tell you one thing. The character of Lila is a great character in season two, but, you know, story-wise, I think the first one is... quite a bit. And it's worth mentioning, I guess, that the show is based on a series of novels, and the first season is based on the first novel, but after that, the show diverges from what the series of books does. So I think the first season is a little bit better at portraying the kind of character Dexter is, and seasons two and three, which as far as I've watched so far, there are moments, individual moments, where he seems to be emotional in a way that I don't quite believe. But
I agree. Well, I've seen season four, and they will explain that for you a little more.
Oh, okay. Cool.
But, well, I think from a pure storytelling perspective, season one is a little tighter, and it definitely kind of has a better ending. But season two, I think, more directly addresses a lot of those questions about, is what he's doing good?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, sure.
And I also like the addiction metaphor, where they through a series of events, basically, Dexter gets enrolled in a 12-step program. Obviously not about serial killing, but for something else. and he kind of uses it to talk about serial killing without actually explaining what his problem is, which that is an interesting, I mean, that's really driving home. This is an addiction, like, you know, you said so many other people have these problems, and people can obviously relate to substance addiction or whatever more readily than serial killing addiction. And so I like season 2 for that reason. I think it's very interesting the way it very deliberately calls out and says, is what he's doing good or bad? I mean, the characters discuss it openly in that season. So
bit of a cheat at the end, though. There's a twist later that kind of lets Dexter off the hook in a way that he should not have been, I think.
True. In fact, I think Dexter is a good example of how it's still sometimes hindered by the television format. The writers of the show seem unwilling sometimes to really live up to the ideas that they have because they kind of want to keep a TV show going. I mean, obviously in real life, this guy would have been caught probably a long time ago. Serial killers just don't generally rack up these kinds of body counts because they make mistakes.
Right. Well, but I like, there was in season 3, I guess, there was a brief line that at least gave some credibility to this. And the idea is that Dexter's day job is he's a forensics guy. He works with the police. And so he's always investigating other crimes and therefore sees the kinds of mistakes that other criminals who get caught make. So, you know, the fact that he is in that position gives a little extra credibility to the fact that he's still able to get away with this.
True. Also, the detectives in the Miami Metro Police Department appear to be the least competent detectives in the history of police detectives. Actually, that's one thing we should mention about Dexter, which is it has these uneven moments, which basically anything that's not about Dexter, all the B-plots, often not good at all, and in fact, sometimes terrible. Some of them are good, but I don't know. It's they need to pad out the season. They don't have enough Dexter storyline for a full 12 or 13 episodes. So
yeah, and I would say they're especially bad in the second season, which is another reason I don't think that's the best one.
Yeah, that is true. That's definitely their worst.
Yeah. In terms of the other characters, yeah.
Yeah,
but you're right. The Dexter storyline in that one is pretty great. So anyway, enough about Dexter. I want to talk about Lost, and I don't have a lot to say about it except that it is probably my favorite show on right now, and I'm just ridiculously crazy about it. It did sort of set a historical precedent here because it's one of the first times, maybe the first time, that a network show has scheduled an end date.
Absolutely.
Three seasons in, the creators of the show went to the studio executives and had said what they've been saying for quite a while and say, hey, look, we only have a certain amount of story. We don't really want to extend it because that's not true to the spirit of what we're doing. We are telling a story with a beginning, middle, and end, and it has to end. If it's still popular, we can't just extend it. Various people have tried to do this on TV before. Babylon 5, well, it's supposed to be 5 seasons. Well, it's still popular at the end of 5 seasons. It'll keep going.
Right.
I think the X-Files went on longer than it should have. The creator was like, no, I'm not going to go past this point, and they went past this point.
Right.
Well, the creators of Lost were like, you know, this story is going somewhere. We know where the end is, and we want to reach it and not try to continue it because that would just not be right. So they negotiated 3 years ahead of time with the network an end date. You know, no matter how popular it is, it's going to reach that end date and end. And so that was something of a precedent with network television. It does tell individual stories season by season, but you wouldn't call, you know, one season a sequel.
Correct.
To the previous one like you would with 24 or The Sopranos. This is also one story end to end, but it is so compelling to me. It's a complex story.
Absolutely.
And they've managed to, you know, the first 3 seasons, like, this isn't leading anywhere. I'm convinced it's not leading anywhere. In fact, Stephen and I argued about it. I think it's probably leading somewhere. And Stephen was like, no, I don't think so. But as long as they have a couple of creepy moments per episode and some cool writing, then, you know, I'm down with it. So, well, it turns out I think they are going somewhere. I think.
Yeah, I was wrong.
Once they scheduled the end date, the writers were able to stop stalling and being hesitant. They were able to say, okay, this is how many hours left, let's tell the rest of the story. And then since then, it's just been on overdrive, and I think, you know, the season 5 is the best yet, 4 was the best up to that point.
Yeah.
And it's ending this year, and I am waiting for the season 6 of Lost as I did for the last Harry Potter book, which was, you know, it's just one of the great storytelling experiences I don't think that's an exaggeration for me, anyway.
Yeah, the cool thing about Lost, what I like about it, is obviously I've come to appreciate the momentum it has now, which the first, especially at some point around the middle of season 3, the show just seemed like it was dragging on and on, and nothing was happening. And then it was awesome, like as soon as the end date occurred, like just was full steam ahead, and they haven't let up since, which has been great fun. But I also like it because it's a sci-fi show that's not about, you know, space aliens with plastic crap on their heads. It feels much more inspired by like sci-fi stories and novels, in that it takes place in the real world with real characters, but there's a science fiction kind of element to it with stuff that's unexplained. You know, the writers have made it very clear that like Philip K. Dick and Stephen King and that kind of sci-fi slash horror slash fantasy that's kind of got a realistic type grounding to it are some of their inspirations, and even to some degree comic books are kind of their inspirations.
And they've also drawn inspiration from classic literature too, so a lot of the mythology of the show is cobbled together from kind of highbrow sources.
Exactly. And it's neat as a fan of science fiction to get that kind of, I mean, really, like what you had on sci-fi before for TV was you get Star Trek or you get The Twilight Zone and not a lot in between. And here we get this long, ongoing science fiction story that is not a ton of crazy tech, but really, really interesting things. And some of the more memorable characters we've had on TV in a long time.
Yeah. It plays with a lot of different types of science fiction, too. Like,
exactly.
Like we recently had a little bit of time travel, and now I guess that's over, and season 6 is going to be... I don't even know what it's going to be about. The season 5 finale was just mind-blowing. I like, too, that it has the complex backstory.
Yeah.
And it's actually another thing that I can compare to Harry Potter. The backstory is as important as the... You know, it's not just a background. It is as important to the present events as, you know, anything else. I find that really fascinating when you connect a storyline that takes place over decades, but you only see it through the eyes of specific characters who only see little pieces of it. That's a fascinating way to tell a story to me.
Yeah. We should also mention that Lost is probably, from a sort of putting together a story perspective, the most complicated show ever put on television.
Yeah.
Not just is the plot itself complicated, but it's told in this fractured way where we mix flashbacks with multiple timelines and multiple... multiple things happening with parallel at different time points. I mean,
there's flashbacks. I mean, it starts out, each show has a set of flashbacks that tell a piece of one story. But then it's like, well, now we're doing flash forwards. Now we're doing alternate timelines. It sounds really confusing. It's not confusing. The way it's told, the only time you get lost is if you don't remember some character that, you know, appeared 3 years
right.
ago, and now here it is. That's why you have, the internet.
But the cool thing is, when they're doing flashbacks and flash forwards, it's not like the characters are having these. It's the story is jumping back in time or forward in time to tell us
right.
information.
Right. That probably relates to what's currently happening in the main story.
Right, but it's like a movie. It's like The Godfather 2 or Pulp Fiction or something. It's or a novel. I've never seen a TV show try to be that complex in terms of telling its story.
And I'm just amazed that it seems to be actually coming together and makes some coherent sense, because it's just a lot to keep track of. You hear about the writers talk about in the writer's room, there's these big charts about different time periods and what characters have met which other characters.
I know.
Seem to keep it mostly straight.
And it's amazing they've been able to do it over 5 seasons now. You know, we've seen a lot of... One of the weird things about TV that we haven't talked about that's a real danger is a show can start well and then spiral downward. Remember the first season of Heroes, when we all thought that was going to be the new Lost, and how wrong we all were. It's like you can tell the Lost people really do have some real standards and some ideas of where they're going. They're not just spinning their wheels.
Right.
Okay, so we got much else to say about TV. We've talked more about TV than we have most movies. So,
no, I think I'm good. I think we have covered the entire history of television.
Well, we didn't
in an hour and a half.
American television.
American television.
We could have done an hour and a half about Monty Python if we really wanted to.
So in England, the television seasons are about 6 episodes long. And okay, now we've done English television.
Excellent.
I don't know what else there is to say about it, honestly.
I think it's mainly about the Queen and tea.
that wraps it up for this episode. Come to our website, allmovietalk.com, and tell us what you think. Always interested in hearing your feedback about the show or about, you know, anything related to movies. Just tell us what movies you've seen recently and that you liked. Also, go to rinkworks.com. What else we got to say before we go? Anything?
That's about it for me.
All right. So we'll be back for another episode sometime in an unspecified future period. All right. Roll the projector. We're done.